I'm Dan.
I'm Jordan. And this is the Money Basics Podcast.
Podcast where we discuss money, budgeting, investing, and everything in between.
And if you like this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share. Every little bit counts, and we don't grow without you. Welcome back, everybody, to our newest episode. We're on episode 18 today. We're recording finally in an empty house in my sunroom. The house is quiet. It's comfy in here. We're on a nice couch.
We've got about six laptops running.
All's good in the world right now. So we kind of fly off the seat of our pants a lot of times thinking about what we should talk about next, unless we get a request. We've had a few of that, those episodes recently. But you know, in the general consensus, we kind of keep thoughts and ideas in our back pocket. And then we kind of like a few days out from getting together, think like, what are we going to talk about this week? So I kind of had an idea of what I wanted to talk about. And then I realized afterwards that I had kind of already written a script about it. I just tweaked a few things after we talked. So today we want to talk about, basically, like I wrote stocks, but I want to talk about investing in general. And the reason that this came up is because, again, I'm very active on the social media app called Blossom. We're going to link it in our description if you guys want to join. You get $5 and so do we. It's absolutely free to you to use, and you literally get paid, and you can never use the app if you don't actually want it and just get the $5 and run away. But the app itself is filled with investors, from what I can tell, new investors, beginners, people who have never even done it at all, to people that have been doing it for years. There's a few people that I admire on there that are close to retirement. They've been investing in various degrees or levels for the last, you know, 20, 30 years, or at least so they say. But what I've really noticed on the app is that there'll be a lot of beginner people come on there and say like, what stocks are good to buy right now? What companies are the best, you know? And there's even ways to not even ask those questions. You can actually go into this app and see what are the top held stocks or top purchase stocks, or they filter and categorize it by, because you can link your brokerage to the app and it tracks all this data. So you can go and find a list of what stocks most of Blossomers or the people that have the app are invested in. And I feel like some people are just going in there, checking out those charts or asking those questions and just buying whatever the heck people say. And I wholeheartedly don't believe in that. That rocks me to my core. That is a wrong approach. And I often will comment on people's requests saying, don't, including me, because I'm a stranger on the internet compared to these people, right? Don't listen to strangers on the internet. It's fine and dandy to listen and or see some recommendations, but just take it with a grain of salt and look into it yourself.
Yeah, and don't trust strangers, and like, never believe the guru. There's no such thing as a guru. In fact, the guru you should listen to is the individual who acknowledges that they don't have all the answers. The person who says they have all the answers are completely misguided and wrong, and they obviously haven't been humbled yet, and that's coming. The smartest people in the world, the smartest people I've ever met, they tend to not acknowledge their own intelligence, and I find that in itself is a sign of intelligence, is understanding your own limitations and limitations in your knowledge, because it's simply not possible to know everything all the time.
Yeah, so digging a little bit deeper, some other comments that I noticed too is like, some people will pop on there and you can tell that like some people seem to know nothing, and they'll just throw out there, what should I buy, is basically what they'll ask. Some people seem to have dug into it a little bit more. Maybe they've read some stock charts. Maybe they checked out Yahoo Finance or Google Finance or some of these other tools. And they'll throw comments out there saying, oh, like this company's at a 52-week low. It's a great time to buy it. Or they'll say like, oh, there's a huge dividend yield. This is an awesome company to buy because it's paying out 7% dividend or something like that. I've been recently, because I was getting a little frustrated answering some of these questions, but I'm throwing those questions back at people now. I'm saying, you know, if someone says, oh, it's at a 52-week low, I'm like, oh, like, you know, think about that. Dig into it a little bit more. Why is it at a 52-week low? Is it a good time to buy the company? So anyway, without getting into it too much, we're going to do that as we go. I want to sort of bring it back. We've done a few episodes like this, but we're going to do some repeat, and there's been some repeats in a lot of our episodes, and that's okay. I want to go dial it right back to try and target some of these people on the specific app, but anywhere, because I feel like the target audience is beginners. And that's our, you know, our spirit of Money Basics. So very high level, what is a stock? A stock is a piece of a company that the companies will throw onto the stock market for people to buy so they can generate money, is basically what it is. They use that money to invest in their own company, to expand, to pay for whatever things, for research and development, so they can create more of what they're making or selling or doing. So then, high level again, what is a dividend? Well, a company, not all companies pay dividends, first of all. And it doesn't necessarily mean that's good or bad. A company will decide to pay a dividend to its shareholders as a strategy. But we have to be mindful that that money comes from somewhere. They companies produce something and they make money for it. They'll take a portion of their profits in some fashion and pay that back to shareholders in the form of a dividend. Now, if a company doesn't pay a dividend, usually what they do is they take all the money and reinvest it back in their company in some way or fashion. And I say usually because not all of them do this. Sometimes, there's deviances and other things that companies do that, may be good or bad or whatever. But that's sort of the difference. So again, not all companies pay a dividend, and just because they do doesn't mean they're a better or worse company than the other. It's nice. I like getting dividends. Dan has a portfolio that is dividend producing, and we do like that, but there's things to watch out for and just be mindful of.
Yeah, and you'll tend to see like there's two real major we'll say competing investing strategies, although in my mind they shouldn't be competing, but you'll see growth stocks and dividend stocks, and there's often this sort of ongoing conversation where you have to pick one or the other. So growth stocks tend to be, not exclusively, but you see a lot of the technology stocks like your Googles and your Microsofts where they pay no dividend or a very, very minor dividend. Because they're taking all that profit that they're making and they're just turning it right back into the company to grow even faster, meaning they see a lot of runway ahead and they think their profits can be better used to invest back into their own company instead of paying it out to shareholders. Versus the flip side of that, a lot of dividend paying stocks, and when I say dividend paying, I mean like a significant dividend, they tend to pay out a larger share of their profits out to shareholders. And you'll see that usually when a company's a little more mature. Their growth runway has slowed quite a bit. So they're not growing like 10, 15, 20% every single year. They're growing like 5 to 10%. And like I'm saying, this is not like exclusive rules. There's always variances to all this stuff. But that's what you tend to see. So some people argue against investing in dividend companies because their growth is slowed versus the growth companies. And if you were to compare growth stocks versus dividend stocks, if you compare their performance over time, you'll hear those crazy stories of like that growth stock that went up like 10,000% or 20,000% over a decade or whatever. And you tend to hear it a little bit less with the dividend stocks, but not necessarily. I mean, they can both be excellent investments, and it just depends on your strategy, and what you're sort of looking to achieve with that. So I think there's a place for both in each person's portfolio. I really like dividend stocks because they help me hold my investment through bad times because I'll still make that dividend paycheck. But I also own some growth stocks as well. So I think a perfect portfolio will have a bit of a mix.
And something that I really zoned in on recently in my own mind is dividend growth companies. And that's been super interesting to me because and what that is it is a company that not only do they pay a dividend, they typically, if they're growing their dividend, they've had a sustainable dividend for some time, usually. And the idea is that so I'll use EQ Bank as an example. EQ Bank, when I started looking at them, they're paying, I think it was a 2% dividend. And they've increased it, what, every quarter for the last two or three quarters or more?
Yeah, well, they've had a very accelerated timeline, but yeah, it's been like every quarter or two you see a pretty big raise lately.
So, and that's really awesome because, like, maybe a company won't be growing, like Dan was saying, in terms of capital gain as fast as another company. But then if you focus on a company that will increase and has a sustainable dividend and increase it, you can make. There's a lot of bank to be made with something like that. Because that growth compounds. And as a shareholder who holds these companies long term, every time or every quarter or every year they decide to increase this dividend, you gain that increase. And then that just adds more to your power of compounding. I don't know if you wanted to elaborate a little bit more on that at all.
Yeah, it's so dividend growth stocks. If you have a really long time horizon, so for example, myself, I'm investing for realistically probably the next 20 to 30 years. So if you were to get in on a really good dividend grower early enough, and you've done your research and you're this is a very good company, and it allows, it's so good that it allows them to grow that dividend over 20 to 30 years, you could end up with a huge dividend yield by the time you actually start using that cash in retirement. So I just pulled up some stats on EQ Bank just to put in perspective how good of a dividend grower they've been. So EQ Bank, being an online-only bank, we both really love. We use their products. And they've been posting incredible financial results. So over the last 3 years, the average dividend per share growth rate was 23% per year, meaning every year they increased the amount of dividend they paid out by 23%. And that compounds on itself, right? So, I mean, I don't know what the exact price was, but let's say their yield was at 1%. If the stock price hadn't changed too much and they grew it by 23%, then that yield would bump up to 1.2%. And then if they did it again, it would be up to like 1.4 something percent. And that would increase and increase, right? Now, obviously, stock prices change, which will change your dividend yield. But the point is, they grow that dividend pretty aggressively. And if they manage to keep that up for like 20 or 30 years, your yield on cost, the amount of dividend that you would make by year 30 of holding the stock, like you might be getting like 40% return on your investment every year. Now, I don't think it's realistic to expect them to maintain a growth rate in their dividend of 23% every year for the next 30 years. It will slow eventually. But if you get in early, you'll probably see good stock price appreciation if they keep posting great results like this. But also, your dividend yield from buying it today at, a 2% or 2.5% yield until 30 years from now, you might be yielding like 40, 50%. Who knows, right? But that's a pretty attractive thing to make your investment back every like 1 to 3 years, like once you're at kind of retirement age.
And that's something that's come up a couple of times too, where people there's a strategy out on that I've noticed that a lot of people do on Blossom is they'll rebalance their portfolio or they'll trim some of their profits, as they say, things like that. And it's not something that I've done yet. I don't know if it's ever something I will actually do because, well, unless our US weed stocks explode, then maybe that's something we'll explore, but they're nowhere near that level yet at all right now. So we won't worry about that. But the rest of my portfolio are dividend paying companies. So one that particularly comes to mind is someone was asking if they should sell. They were talking about buying Bell or Telus, and they were talking about should they sell some of their Bell or Telus. And both Bell and Telus being big Canadian telecoms, they're one of the big, whatever it is, three or four in Canada. They both pay a nice sustainable dividend. And my argument to them was, why would you sell? And they said, well, I hold them in this ETF that I have lots of shares in. And I said, fair enough, but like these two companies are paying you this nice dividend. They've also been growing their dividend. Why get rid of it? In my mind, like you could keep it and compound this dividend growth for a long time, and then you would be sitting at, maybe a yield on cost of 30% or 40%, right? Or whatever the number is. I'm just throwing that out there because that's what we used.
So Bell was the last 10 years they've grown their dividend by an average of 5.2% per year every year for 10 years. And, some years it might be 2%, some years it might be 9%, but it averages out to 5.2% per year. And when I look at my dividend growth stocks, I like stocks that tend to have a bit of a track record of dividend growth. And Bell and Telus as well, they're both well-established older companies. So if I see like an average growth rate over the last 10 years of 5% or above, I'm usually fairly happy with that. Obviously, the higher the number, the better. But yeah, I mean, if you own a lot of these things through an ETF, it might make sense to trim your position outside of the ETF if you're uncomfortable being that overweight. But sometimes it can be strategic to have an ETF that holds these stocks and then also buy these stocks on their own outside of the ETF if you wanted to increase your exposure to them. So, for example, I own VDY, the Vanguard ETF. It holds basically all the big Canadian dividend payers, but I also hold some Canadian bank stocks on their own outside of that. So why would I do that? I'm doubling down on the same investment in different vehicles, right? But I do that because I purposely want to have a heavy weighting in Canadian banks. So that's an intentional decision I've made. It's not necessarily a bad thing to go overweight on certain sectors or certain companies. It kind of works both ways. It could blow up in my face. The banks could do terrible and it would bring my whole portfolio down more than somebody who just went in through an ETF. But the flip side is if the banks do well, my portfolio will do much better than somebody who just went with the ETF. So, I mean, it depends if it fits into your overall strategy, but it could make sense sometimes to be overweight on companies that you have a lot of faith in.
And just to reiterate, like this whole podcast has always been about what we do. We have lived experience. We're not professionals. I'm not saying that any style is right or wrong, or if trimming is right or wrong, or holding both the companies in ETF or individually is right or wrong. And neither is Dan. But it's just a strategy that I haven't really done yet. And it's to me, I'm holding on to my companies for a very long time. I'm taking advantage of this dividend growth, and I'm happy to just sit there and hold these companies. Now, that all being said. So we're talking about all these numbers, we're throwing this stuff out there. And something that I always encourage when folks are coming on Blossom, they're pretty new, as I say, look into the company. What do I mean by that, looking into the company? Well, what you should really dive into, and I'll go into my process a little bit for this, but what you should be looking at is their investor relations page. Every company is legal that are listed on a publicly traded company listed on a stock market are legally obligated to list their filings. So that's their annual reports, which includes all the numbers that you would need. That means any earnings, income, taxes, all that stuff. And each company has their investor relations page, and you can easily Google and find any company that's listed on a publicly traded market, and go into their investor relations page and find all these things. They'll have things like presentations, but what you really should be looking at is their earnings reports or their annual reports or their quarterly reports, things like that. So to back it up a little bit, what I typically do or what I have done to build my portfolio and what I continue to do is there's two tools that I use, and I'm going to caution you about them. One, most of my portfolio is on Google Finance. I like the layout of Google Finance. I can create my watch lists. I can see all the sort of high level information that's there. It's a stock chart, shows you the 52-week high and low, shows you the dividend yield, all that kind of stuff, and then they break down news. I find the news section of the specific company in Google's clunky. I prefer the news section on Yahoo Finance. So I have basically two different watch lists. So my Yahoo Finance just kind of has all my companies in one. Google, I have a little more specific ones. I like how Yahoo Finance breaks down the news section of certain companies. So there you'll see things like when they're paying, like the news section will show like, oh, when's the company paying their dividend? Oh, like this news article came out, all these things. But they'll also throw in there, this company announced that they're going to do their quarterly report on such and such a date. So you can look at it, maybe even join the live call, go on the website and do the live webinar stuff, listen to them actually talk about it if you have time to do that. But what I also like is that the Yahoo Finance will capture data from other places. Two that I sort of like are there's like an app or a website called Zacks, and there's another one called Simply Wall Street. They'll throw their information on there from their analysts, and I'm doing bunny ears for analysts because I feel like, although I may not be 100% right on this, but I feel like it's an algorithm, especially for Simply Wall Street. They tend to just sort of throw every company into this algorithm, and it spits out all this information for shareholders or for people to look at. And some of it can be a little off, which is the caveat that I have to throw in here by using these tools. And I've learned this very much in detail recently. So I will go on check out the earnings breakdown. So Simply Wall Street will typically put in a summary of an earnings breakdown of a certain company, which I find very, you can read through it very quickly, and you can see, hey, the company's making money or the company's losing money. And they'll throw it out there. They'll be like, oh, like their year over year was good, or their quarter over quarter was good. And they'll break down that information. And if I see anything in there that I don't like, that, oh, they didn't make money this quarter, or there's debt, or there's something that sort of flags for me, then I will go in and check out their actual filings and look at that information myself. And that's kind of so then that's where I go into the investor relations page. I'll go into the annual and the quarterly reports and I'll look at it. Now, I'll have to admit that version of looking at this information for me is very dry. I don't find it super interesting at all. I am very bored looking at it, and sometimes I'm looking at it and it's very confusing. So I'll consult with my brother Dan here because he's got a little more of a bead on it than I do. If I see something that I'm like, what am I really looking at here? I have a few people I can reach out to ask that I trust, that I know that they have a little bit more or much better understanding than I do about it. But it is pretty easily broken down, to be honest. They'll show you the numbers basically of everything, and you can see it year over year, quarter over quarter, and they break all that down. So you can see if the company's making money or not and do all that kind of stuff in those sections.
Yeah, Simply Wall Street's a good tool if you want flashy visuals and a quick, like, 10-second glance. The problem with it is it is created, it heavily relies on AI to, like, put these little graphs and spreadsheets and flow charts together. So the data has to be taken with a grain of salt. So I don't ever rely on that exclusively. I mostly just use Simply Wall Street. If you scroll right down to the bottom of any company page, they have actually a pretty nice chart of insider buys and insider ownership. That's usually where I check for that stuff, just because it's super easy to find and it's kind of nice and flashy to see. So yeah, I mean, if I see a company that has a lot of insider ownership or high-level people are buying hand over fist recently, that's really, really good. And that's, like, kind of one of the litmus tests that a company needs to pass for me to buy. If nobody's been buying recently, or even worse, if somebody's been selling a lot recently, that's a big red flag, and I usually just walk away and stop my research right there. As for the rest of the stuff on Simply Wall Street, there can be value there, but the problem is, because it's like this AI generated stuff, it's not very contextual to like the specific company or sector. So you'll see, like, it might tell you, like, the dividend payout ratio is like 180%, which would normally be a really red flag. That would mean the company's paying out way more than it's earning, which means it's going to cut its dividend soon or have to issue more shares or debt to pay for it, which is bad. But then if you deep dive a little bit, like I challenge you right now to look at any major Canadian REIT on Simply Wall Street. They're pretty much all going to have dividend payout ratios over 100%. But that's because the website, the AI, doesn't seem to know that it needs to base that payout ratio off FFO instead of its earnings per share. So just, I mean, we're starting to get into some different lingo here now. But the point is, it's not super accurate because they apply a one size fits all approach to something that is not one size fits all.
I'll throw a very tangible example out there. So I got into a couple of debates with some people that have thrown out there two stocks that I remember talking about. One was Enbridge. Actually, we talked about REITs, so SmartCentres, RioCan, as the two examples. Then we talked about Enbridge and we talked about TELUS. And people were throwing up on Blossom, like, oh my God, Enbridge has like a 268% dividend payout ratio. And this is crazy and unsustainable and blah, blah, blah. Now, like, I don't remember all this information off the top of my head. I own a lot of shares of Enbridge. I like the company. And I couldn't, off the top of my head, say what exactly the payout ratio was. I hadn't looked into it in a while. But what I did know, and this is a good example in the difference, I think, between you and I's process. You're a little more logical, a little more intellectual. I'm a little more emotional. Behavior, I guess, if that makes sense. And as this example, I know that Enbridge has been paying their dividend for 28 years. That's a fact. I've looked that up because I was like, they've been paying it for a long time. I Googled it as I was looking at this. 28 years, and they've been increasing it within that time frame as well. So in my mind, I thought, like, how in the heck can it be 268% payout ratio when they've been paying it for 28 years and increasing it some of those years as well? Doesn't make sense. So I need to look into this a little more further, what this person's saying, right? Random person on the internet saying random stuff. So then I consulted with Dan at the time. I don't know if you remember that. It was a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, okay, what the heck is and what do I need to look at? So as it turns out, apparently, I don't know when, but in the last couple of years, lawmakers have changed the language. How does that work? They changed the way that these payout ratios are calculated from energy or utility stocks.
Yeah, I can't remember the details on the discussion there. I remember we deep dived it, and I was explaining it to you, and going through their most recent couple of quarters. I'd gone through it, and it's because they calculate. I don't remember why the payout ratio appears so high, but I remember. I think it was it AFFO that we had to go off of, or some kind of adjusted number. I'd have to go back and do my research again on it. But essentially, the general metric that people use, which is going off of EPS numbers, it makes an artificially high dividend payout ratio when really the money that they're using to pay out the dividend, from an accounting perspective, shouldn't be taken from that pool. It should be taken from a cash flow pool. And their cash flow from operations, which pays out the dividend, is quite high and very, very sustainable. And they say it themselves. So in every company's quarterly reports, they have all the numbers, they're all the financials, but you kind of have to be like a semi, at least like a semi-trained accountant to make sense of all of it. And for the average person, it's difficult to do. But what the average person can do is you can look up the, there's a quarterly report, MD&A. It's a management discussion and analysis. It's basically the quarterly report with paragraphs inserted underneath each section with management explaining what these numbers means, why they come to them, and if they fall into their guidance, what they're hoping to achieve, and why numbers are the way they are. And that can be super enlightening. You got to take it with a slight grain of salt because obviously they're going to try to make things as rosy as possible because they want their company to look good. But you can look at some of the stuff, and there are some things that can be so bad, not specifically with Enbridge, but some things can be so bad that like even management can't make it seem rosy. Like you can see right through the BS. But I would encourage if you're gonna have a big position in an individual company, go through at least the most recent quarter and annual MD&A, the management discussion analysis. Read the whole freaking thing, top to bottom. It's like 140 pages. Do your homework. If you want to get into the big leagues, investing huge amount of money into individual stocks, you got to put in the time and the effort. It might be thousands of your own dollars on the line, depending on what you're investing. So if you're gonna put the money to work, do the homework beforehand and read that stuff. And if you're not willing to do it, then maybe a different strategy is more appropriate for you.
Yeah, so when we were deep diving Enbridge together to, for the sake of this argument on the app, it turns out that their payout ratio was well within the range of that the management themselves has set. And I think it was between 60 and 70%
Yeah, I was just gonna
ratio.
say it was somewhere around the mid 60% was what they were aiming for, and they were mostly achieving that, the payout ratio obviously based on a cash flow basis.
And like I don't have personally, I don't have a process. Like I don't sit there and be like, okay, like after 3 months, I'm gonna review all my companies in my portfolio. Like I haven't really set something like that. I think you might do something like after a certain amount of time, you sort of look at it. But I liked these discussions for these companies because I hold all these companies, and it actually forced me because I wanted to be right in what I was saying to this person. But in the process, I was actually looking at companies that I own, and it just reinforced the fact of why I own them. And I'm super comfortable holding my positions with Enbridge. I'm very happy collecting the very sustainable dividend as an example for this this discussion right here. And then the same thing goes with the REITs, the real estate investment trusts like SmartCentres and RioCan appear to have a very high payout ratio. But again, you have to calculate the payout ratio different with the FFO, which is funds from operation. And if you look at the FFO for both RioCan and SmartCentres, I think RioCan's in the 70s or 80% payout ratio.
Yeah, I think they're below 80. They're like high 60s, low 70s, something
Yeah,
like
and
that.
SmartCentres is in the 90s. They are much higher.
Yeah, and what's interesting is with these two, I was kind of looking through them, and funds from operation is the appropriate metric to judge that payout ratio, but also take into consideration the AFFO, the adjusted funds from operation. And if you read through these financial reports, they'll actually explain in the subtext what that adjustment is. So like what they're using to calculate these numbers. And SmartCentres can be a little misleading, showing a higher payout ratio. And I believe for them the AFFO was a better thing, or at least in my opinion, I thought it was a better thing to look at. Because SmartCentres business is kind of diversified, right? They make a lot of money by renting out, leasing out space, right? So they're Walmart's biggest landlord. And then they rent out stuff to all sorts of places like your drug shops, grocery stores, retail, all these things. That's kind of their bread and butter. But they're expanding heavily, as is RioCan, into residential real estate, especially in big cities like Toronto and the GTA. And there's big money to be made there because population's booming and there's not enough affordable housing. So they're putting up these huge apartment buildings, and you can see it in their quarterly reports. That they're building a combination of condos, townhouses, and high-rise apartment buildings. And a lot of their income comes from leasing these places. They're going to own these buildings for a very long time, and they're going to rent them out to people, collect the rent, and that's how they make their money. But a small percentage of SmartCentres holdings, they actually build like townhouses, for example, and then sell them off at a profit once they're done. And that they use some of that money to pay out their dividend. And I don't have the sheets right in front of me. This is not something that I'm some super genius to just memorize and just know everything off the top of my head. I got to sit down and look at these things. But just from memory, I believe the AFFO from SmartCentres accounted for those one-time sales, and the FFO did not, or maybe it was the other way around. But my point is, there's a lot of different metrics that companies use to basically show where the money's coming from and where it's going to. So you got to make sure you understand the ins and outs of those financial statements instead of just seeing that headline of like, oh my God, 200% payout ratio, because that headline's not always entirely accurate. So it's important to read through the MD&A, the financial statements, and try to understand where the money's coming from and where it's going.
Yeah, before we get too much into that, because that's going to be our next little section here, I did want to bring up a conversation that I had with somebody recently. It wasn't about dividend payout ratios, but they had said something like, BlackBerry's looking good as a company, and that's all they said. And then they sort of shared a picture of a chart, and I looked at it, and it was like the last month they were up like 6% or 7%, or maybe it was less. But anyway, they're green a little bit. And I zoomed out looking at the last 5 years and then like the max chart on Google Finance. And like, they're down, like it's crazy. And so I only respond to this person, like, is it looking good? And I'm trying to like entice people to look into this information, like to put some meat behind their statements, you know? And I understand like this person threw up a title saying being an investor. So I'm just trying to like, cause like you had done that to me way back, like when I was learning how to do things.
That's a game that, you know, we play, and I've challenged a few people on Blossom to it. And I don't mean to sound like a dick about it. The game I play when somebody likes a company, they'll say, hey, this company seems good. We'll basically take opposing sides on it. Whether or not I like that company or not, we'll play a game where you tell me why you like this company and I'll try to tell you why it's a terrible company. And we'll see who's has the more compelling argument.
And what I noticed in the sake of this example is that this person was just very speculative. They're just saying, oh, you know, like, BlackBerry's been around this long. They're a Canadian company. They've dropped. You know, they just sort of threw a lot of high level stuff without getting into the meat and potatoes of things. And I was trying to get them to look at the meat and potatoes. And the person, again, not face to face with this person's hard to tell. And I'm, you know, I'm not trying to insult this person, but they were just saying, "Oh, I've looked into the company. Like I know them," and they weren't giving me the meat and potatoes. And it's kind of funny because like I deep dived BlackBerry like 3-4 years ago. I was interested in investing in them at the time. And from my research, it made me decide that it just wasn't a company I wanted to invest in. So I didn't. But I've kind of kept an eye on them very loosely because they have dipped quite a bit. They, you know, it kept on my radar thinking like maybe this is a company to get in when they're low and maybe they'll get higher. I don't know. So I've been sort of loosely keeping an eye on them. Someone had made a comment about, actually it was that Bradley guy. I don't know if you saw that. He was like, I forget the guy's name, some name, Prem Willis or somebody seems to like the company a lot. And I'm reading the comment. I was like, who the hell is that? So I Googled it and I Googled the name that he had used and BlackBerry. And he's a majority shareholder. He's a rich, like hedge fund, somebody, blah, blah, whatever, owns like a whole bunch of BlackBerry. And in me just reading this in literally 5 minutes, I saw an article saying how he had put in some vote to do something and 50% of the board said no. And like 51% of the voting shareholders said no. So then I threw a comment back saying like, well, like apparently the board doesn't like this guy, so I'm not too like whether he's right or wrong with the company, they hate him. And the guy's like, yeah, that's true. The reason I'm bringing that up is because like, again, like I'm having these conversations, I'm deep diving the companies a little bit, but like deep diving, like I literally Googled this guy with BlackBerry and like found this information. It's not hard. It's very doable for anyone to find information out there and get a little more knowledge on a company and see what's going on. Anything else you want to add to that before we sort of get into our more specific breakdown?
Yeah, I think it's actually quite easy to rule a company out of my investment process. And I think with a little bit of knowledge, a lot of people can go over these basic things. And I don't know if you want to get into sort of more specifics on our process. Maybe I'll save some of these little tidbits, but
well, you can go ahead. Like I explain what I do.
Sure. Like within 5 minutes, I can usually do sort of like a really quick sweep, basically looking for major red flags in a company for why I would not buy into them. Let's say 5 to 10 minutes, because sometimes things are a little more confusing. But like I said, one of my first checks I do is Simply Wall Street. Really, you can find this from other sources, but that's where I go. And I look for insider buying and selling. If there's major insider selling, that's a red flag. I'm pretty much going to be out. A little tiny bit of insider selling, not a big deal. Sometimes they do that for tax purposes or whatever. But recent insider buying, that's usually kind of a more of a green flag. I won't just blindly buy in, but I see that, I like it, and I keep going with my research. But massive selling, I'm out. From there, the next thing that I do is I go to Yahoo Finance. And what I'll do is I'll go to, they have a financial section. Now, I found some inaccuracies in this, but it's generally pretty good. So if I'm just doing like a high level quick look, I'll go to the Yahoo Finance financial section of the company and I'll go through the income statement, the balance sheet, and the cash flow tabs, and I'll look at the annual view. So you can see it'll date back at the time that we're looking at it. It's showing me from 2019 to the present last 12 months. So you get a couple of years of history of the company. So the top line, what I'll look at is revenue. Is revenue increasing steadily, or is the general trend towards an increase? So like if 2019, like right now I'm looking at TELUS just as an example. So if 2019 is like 14 and a half, I guess that would be billion. Then the next year is 15, the next year is 16, the next year is 18. Like that's an increasing trend, and that's great, right? If I saw it was a decreasing trend, if it was decreasing like clockwork, that's a red flag. I'm out. I'm gonna stop my research right there. And then I'll go through a couple other metrics, but I don't think I want to get too down the rabbit hole. But essentially, I'm looking for trends, increases in the good things and decreases in the bad things, right? And if the trends are going the wrong way, especially on these big ticket items, that makes me super skeptical about the investment, especially if I see this across multiple metrics.
So keep in mind, well, I just want to comment about the insider buying and selling. So typically when you have big CEOs or people that don't, like, are really involved in the company buying, that's usually a really good sign because that means that they believe in the company. Usually they believe in it long term. They're putting skin in the game. They're putting their own money into the company. Usually that's a good sign, versus selling. Now, I have noticed recently that a lot of tech companies nowadays are a lot of insider selling right now.
As they should be. There's a very good argument to be made that they're heavily inflated in valuations, meaning everyone's buying into tech right now and the stocks are just going up and up and up. If I was a CEO and I'm looking at my stock and I'm like, my stock should not be this high, I would start selling. And I feel like that could even be strategic because the CEOs know that us low-level investors, been right across the whole spectrum into these Wall Street people, like people watch what the CEOs do. So if a CEO sells a significant portion, then the general investor is probably going to start selling too, thinking if the CEO wants out, I want out, right? So I think a smart CEO can use that to their advantage. When their stock is heavily inflated, they're thinking one of these days the bubble's going to burst and everyone's going to rush for the gates and my stock is going to absolutely plummet. So I think that they can like taper that response a little bit by purposely selling when the stock is high and overinflated in their opinion. And they can sell, not they're not going to sell every share they own, but they could sell a significant portion that will tell the general market, like, hey, we should probably get out too, but not everyone's going to rush to the door. So you might see like an artificially created dump on the stock a little bit. And they might do that to make sure that one day when the bubble bursts, it's not as bad because they've been kind of, coaxing people along before it got to that point. And CEOs can do the other way as well. Like some CEOs, when their company's in a bad position, think our weed stocks right now, our American weed stocks. I don't touch the Canadian ones. If their stocks are in the gutter and they're looking and thinking like, listen, there's some catalysts on the horizon. We need to pick me up in the stock price. They might purposely buy some of their own stock because they know people will see that and respond in kind, and they might buy as well. And the CEO might do that even if they know that catalyst is like another year or two out. They might do it just to give their stock a short-term price bump. Not every CEO is going to do that, but these are strategies that the CEOs and high-level executives can use to sort of manipulate their stock price a little bit either way.
So in the discussion around the tech stocks, that's way more information than I even anticipated. So thanks for sharing that. Because what I had shared on Blossom, someone mentioned that there's a lot of insider selling. I think it was Nvidia we were talking about, which is a big tech company in the States. My comment was I'd probably sell too if my stock was that inflated to reel in some of my profits. But that's good insight. So thanks for sharing that as well. And then on the same breath for like the US weed stocks, I remember one time, so one there's one CEO that's pretty active on Twitter that, well, two, Jordan, Boris Jordan and Kim Rivers. Kim Rivers is the CEO of Trulieve Cannabis. And the one time she had tweeted out saying, "Don't worry, guys, everything's good," and like bought what was like $1 million worth of stock of Trulieve. So that's just an example of like sometimes how CEOs will do things on purpose to try and,
Comfort their shareholders. And I like to see that. Like, insider buying is good because, and I wrote an article about this, like, if the CEO's incentives are aligned with mine, they're probably gonna work towards what I want them to work towards. You know what I mean? Like, if they've got skin in the game, and you know, like, we're talking about the Kim Rivers, CEO of Trulieve. I'm pretty sure she's the biggest shareholder of the company, or if not, definitely one of the biggest shareholders. So who do you think cares most about the stock price of that company over time? Like, that person has a lot more to lose than I do, being like a 0.001% shareholder. So I like having CEOs who are heavily invested in their own companies, because they're going to want the company to succeed more than anybody if they've got a lot of skin in the game. Because if it doesn't succeed, they're going to lose way more money, right?
And just to let everybody know, everything we've talked about so far, we haven't even like gone into the annual reports yet, really. I mean, this information is all on Yahoo Finance that Dan's looking at right now. So we haven't even like gotten into anything crazy yet. This is very flashy information, very easy to find.
And like I said, Yahoo Finance is a really great resource, but I have found inaccuracies on it. So like I said, when I look through there, this is like high level stuff. I'm looking at a number of metrics. It'll depend on the company and the industry that they're in, but generally I'm looking at like trends in revenue, trends in debt, trends in cash flows and cash balances, trends in debt levels. I like to look at both gross and net incomes, and then the trends in those things. And then, you know, if those are checking a lot of the boxes for me and I decide to go further into more research on the company, then I start getting into the quarterly and annual reports and I cross-reference it to make sure those Yahoo numbers were correct. I'll even make spreadsheets on my Google Drive to keep my thoughts straight on this. And I create folders of research for the companies that I'm going in heavy. So it's a lot of work. Like, I don't just look at a company for 2 minutes and then spend a couple grand on it. Like, that's ridiculous. How much can I really know about a company if I spend 2 minutes on it? If I'm going to do 2 minutes of research and buy something, it's going to be something like an ETF, where there's many, many companies. It's broadly diversified. To me, that's kind of like the lazy route of doing this. If I'm going to go really heavy into an individual company, I study a lot. Like the one I'm studying right now is Brookfield, the whole family of Brookfields. I'm kind of looking at all angles of it. I've been talking about this for what, like 2, 3 weeks now, and I still haven't bought a significant stake. I think I've got like $300 of Brookfield. I find having a little bit of money in these companies, having skin in the game motivates me to dig down a bit deeper. So sometimes, you know, as my confidence grows, I'll sort of scale a position in versus like I'm not just going to study for like 2 months straight and then drop 10 grand. I'll study a fair bit and I'm like, okay, I actually really like this company. I'll put in like $100 or $200. I'll keep studying. And as the story makes more and more sense, I tend to add more. And then at a certain point, if there's an opportunity, I might go in super heavy. But it's a process. It takes a lot of time. And if I don't want to do that kind of research, then I don't make huge positions. So like, I don't study every single company I own to this extent, but I've got maybe about five or six of my portfolios that are heavy positions. And I study those ones very thoroughly. All the other little small positions where it's like a couple $100 here and there, I don't study much at all. I basically go the ETF approach. And get diversity and just sort of do the passive investing thing.
And again, to be clear, an ETF is a basket of stocks. So companies will put out an ETF that just has a whole bunch of different companies in it. So when Dan says the easy way is just like typically if you, I'm just gonna throw it out there. If anything we've been talking about so far is gibberish to you and this is just like repulsing you, then maybe doing something like an ETF is a better route. And that's just a company that has put together a whole bunch of stocks. You put some money into that specific ETF, and the money just automatically gets distributed. And it's a real set it and forget it way with a pretty low cost fee typically. And it's sort of the easy way to do it instead of deep diving these companies. And like I the overarching idea of all this is that what we're trying to really drive into this episode and into you, the listener, and whomever else, is you shouldn't just newfie dive into buying a company. You know, trusting internet strangers and all kind of stuff, including us. Like even us talking about the companies we've talked about and what we're talking about now. Like don't take our word for it, you know? Like go and do your own thing, go and look at it yourself. You know, we could be full of crap, you know, like we might not know what we're talking about. We have lived experience, sure, but we're not professionals. You know, we're just arguably just like you. So, yeah, I mean, it's just what we want to throw out there.
Yeah, and I would argue for the absolute beginner, in my opinion, the ETF strategy is the way to go. So buying the basket of stocks, that's sort of the lowest effort strategy and tends, depending what you invest in, tends to produce the best results. In fact, the person who just passively buys a little bit of everything, statistically tends to smoke the person who picks and chooses the stocks. Now, there's always going to be exceptions to this rule, and there's ways that very intelligent people can skew the odds in their favor by buying individual stocks and beating the ETF investor. If we're talking in general, like the general population, the passive ETF investor usually smokes the stock picker. And basically the analogy is like, if you don't know anything about stocks, so imagine Jordan and I go to the horse track right now. We don't know anything about horse tracks, horse racing, or betting. Okay. Now imagine we have a lineup of, I don't know what there is. Let's say there's 16 horses. Once again, I know nothing about horse racing. Now, Jordan and I, we don't know a single thing, and we want to bet on this race. It's like Jordan can pick number one, and I can pick number 15, and we don't know anything about these horses. They might be terrible. The one might have a broken leg. We don't know. Well, and we're just hoping to roll the dice and get a win. We're probably going to do much worse than somebody who, for some reason, had the ability to bet on all 16 of these horses just having a good time. You know what I mean? And that's what ETF investing is. You're not betting on any individual player to win. You're betting on all the players to have a good time. And in general, by investing in a little bit of every company, the general stock market, the trend is up and to the right over time. Right. So if you invest in a big basket of a whole lot of companies and you've got a very long time horizon, the longer your time horizon doing this strategy, the less likely it is that you lose money. And I had a chart somewhere. I'll probably post it one of these days. But it basically shows the odds of you losing money doing this strategy over time. And it shows how over time it decreases your odds of losing money. So it's like anyone who invests in a 1 year period, you've got something like a 50-50 chance of earning or losing money. In a 5 year period, you've got like a 60 or 65% chance of earning money, but you might lose. And then you extend that out to 20 years, and it's like a 99% chance you're going to make money. And if you extend that out to 30 years, like it's like a 99.8% chance that you're going to earn money. So those are kind of your ways to ensure success. Now, we don't have a crystal ball. There could be a nuclear war or some crazy thing happen that changes this dynamic, but historically speaking, a broad diversified stock portfolio, owning a little bit of every company, betting on every horse over a long period of time should get you a win.
If you want to dial it back, even so, that's easy mode investing,
Yeah, that
basically.
is easy mode.
If you want to dial it back to super easy mode, it's going to cost you a little more. But if you want to do it like you literally don't even have to look at it at all, which I don't encourage you to do, you should always look at what you're investing in, even if it's doing it for you. There are robo-vesting vessels out there. And the one that I would recommend and that my wife is doing with some of her portfolio is through Wealthsimple. They have automated investments. You basically just set your risk tolerance, put money in it, and they just invest for you. They literally invest in ETFs. They charge a 0.5% fee with which some of these ETFs will charge you a 0.05% fee or less. So yes, it is kind of, well, it is a significant more fee, but still much cheaper than something like a mutual fund with a money manager like from the bank or one of these financial
Yeah,
institutions. That is something that is not Money Basics approved.
no, we do not approve. In Canada, we have some of the highest mutual fund fees of anywhere, and you can see them up like 2% plus. So basically, your investment needs to earn better than 2% just for you to break even. So imagine like it was a rough year. You look at your portfolio and your mutual funds earned a 3% return that year. Well, you don't get to take home a 3% return. You take home a 1% return because 2% is fees. Win, lose, or draw, they get their fees. Versus ETFs, which do basically the same thing. Depending on what you invest in, your fees can be as low as like 0.05, ranging up to like 0.6, 0.7 for more active ETFs. But you tend to see much lower fees for a product that performs just as well, if not better. When you account for those fees. That being said, I would never personally approve of mutual funds. That's more of like an old person thing. But our parents invested in mutual funds their whole lives, like back in the 1940s. They've done quite well, all things considered. Like that's their retirement fund is all parked in mutual funds. And yeah, sure, it's probably not the most efficient way of doing it, but it's hard to argue with the results. Like, they've got a retirement nest egg as a result of that. So if their option was do nothing or invest in mutual funds, they certainly have done quite well investing in mutual funds. So I'm not saying that mutual funds are the absolute devil and they'll ruin you. I'm just saying I really, really don't like them and I would never recommend them. But hey, I mean, some people find success with that sort of thing.
There's something to be said too about index investing. So to go back to ETFs, I've listened a lot to my favorite investors to listen to is a guy named Peter Lynch. He talks about value investing, but does throw it out there saying if you don't want to do any research in companies, you should just index ETF by the entire stock market. Set it, forget it, don't worry about it. You can hear him talk about this stuff. I've thrown this out in different episodes, but they're still available. He's got two audiobooks on Spotify. They are absolutely free. He narrates them. He's very interesting to listen to. You can literally listen to this book while you're driving or walking or doing whatever. Of course, after listening to our podcast. And the other one I listened to recently was so there's a book out there called Random Walk Down Wall Street. Burton Malkiel is the author. I listened to a podcast where these guys interviewed him. I'll have to find it. We'll try and link it in a description. But he says he is a huge believer, a huge advocate and promoter of index ETF investing. I think they're based out of the US, so they talk more about like index funds versus saying ETFs, because ETFs very much a Canadian thing, is it not?
No, ETFs are American as
Okay,
well.
never mind. But anyway, so the point is that he's a huge, don't why try to beat the market? Just join them, buy every company, bet on every horse.
That's one funny. Now, I don't go on Blossom as much as Jordan. I'll pop on there once in a while, but not that often. But that's one funny argument that I often see on there where people are like, they keep using the term diversification, which, like, oh, that's cute. But basically, they're saying that index investing, like buying a little bit of everything, is worse than picking and choosing certain individual investments. Because if you buy the general market, if you do this index fund thing, if you bet on all the horses to have fun, you're never going to do better than the market. In their rationale, what their point of this is saying, you should pick a few very good companies, and that way you'll smoke the market. What they refuse to acknowledge is that, one, a lot of people fail doing this. Two, not everybody has the time to do that level of research or has the background knowledge to do adequate research to know what a good company is. And then my biggest point is why do you need to beat the market? Like, what is your obsession with beating the market? The market, depending on what time period you draw from, but historically, somewhat recently, you're looking at about 11% a year compounding every year. No, I shouldn't say every year, but the average over like a 30-year time span of the S&P 500 is like an 11% gain year over year, compounding on itself for 30 years. If you can't get rich over a long enough time period getting 11% a year, there's something wrong with your strategy here. You got to cut back somewhere and invest more. But it really, if you start early, it really doesn't take that much money contributing to that kind of investment where you just get the same return as the general market and you end up a millionaire by retirement. You just got to start early enough, be disciplined, and stick with it. I mean, if you want to take all your chips and bet them all on black and hope for the best, go for it. But you also run the risk of wiping yourself out, right? Versus the passive index investor, the person who just buys a little bit of everything, they're almost guaranteed, assuming they stick to the appropriate strategy and don't do anything crazy with it, they're almost guaranteed to be a millionaire if they just draw out their time horizon long enough. So I don't get that argument. I don't get why everyone's so obsessed with trying to beat the market. I'm happy to just meet the market. If I beat it, that's great. I actually do have a small portion of my portfolio that I put towards crazy investments, like hoping to smoke the market. But I'm like 90% basically investing, more or less index investing, and 10% those wild bets, which is my American weed stocks. But if I get completely wiped out on that, it sucks. But I still have 90% of my investments that are in good, healthy, long-term bets that I hope to hold for 30 plus years.
And just to emphasize, why do all this research? Like, why are we looking into these companies this much? And a huge advantage for me is in a market downturn or when these companies are going down in value, I'm not sweating it. And that's the biggest peace of mind thing for me. I've seen a lot of people sort of post sometimes be like, oh my God, like company's gone down 15, 20% or whatever it is. Oh, we should sell. It's all this crap. Look at like market sentiment is something, right? Like people People get crazy. They get fear built in them. People sell for all kinds of different reasons. Analysts come on the news and they go, "Oh, you know, this is a sell," and all this stuff. And I'm not saying that analysts are right or wrong. They have a job to do, and I get it. But you know, this is why, like, I research my companies. I have my values and things that I look at. And when these things tend to happen and the companies go down, that makes me happy because I buy more. Because to me, that means that these companies are on sale because I've looked into them. I know that they're solid. They're doing well. Their earnings are good. This is just some black cloud bullshit, basically, and it's advantageous to me because I'll just buy more.
Yeah, I've been listening a lot in my research of Brookfield. I've been listening a lot to Bruce Flatt, CEO of Brookfield Corporation. He's a Canadian fella born in, I think it was Manitoba, if I'm not mistaken, but very like low key person, not very flashy, but yet he's worth billions. And he's nicknamed the Canadian Warren Buffett. And he's a young enough guy, he's like 50 or 60. But listening to him talk, and he's done a few interviews, and there's some stuff, interviews with him on Spotify you can find. But his mentality on long-term investing is so refreshing, where basically his whole mindset is buy good quality things with good people at a good price, and just ride it out. And if you're confident in your investment under those criteria, like don't worry about the day to day. It doesn't matter. Look ahead 10, 15, 20 years, and that's where the biggest, gains are found. Right. And he made a point on one of his interviews about like one of the worst things for investors to ever happen was the internet connecting in real time to stock prices. Watching your stock fluctuate minute by minute is the worst thing that's happened for the beginner investor, because people watch these fluctuations, they panic, they freak out, and they sell when they shouldn't, or sometimes they'll buy things when they shouldn't. They'll buy into the euphoria, and they'll sell into the fear. And he made the analogy of imagine if your primary residence, your house did that. Imagine you could watch the value of your house go up and down minute by minute. How many people would panic sell their own houses? But you don't really see that because the market is very slow moving on housing. Like you don't get a real-time update of your house value. In fact, you can look at comparables in your neighborhood, but most people don't really do that, or at least not very frequently. Right. So people will sit in their house for 30 years and just pay their mortgage and don't worry about the value going up and down, because they're pretty confident that in 30 years their house will be worth more than what it was when they bought it. Right. So he makes that analogy that if you buy very high quality companies run by high quality people and you get them in at a good price, your best strategy is probably just to walk away from it and stop looking at it all the time, you know, and go back to it, check, make sure your thesis is still intact once in a while, but don't worry about the day to day. I thought that was pretty insightful.
For the sake of time, I don't want to get too much into it any further. We're at an hour. We've talked a lot about numbers and different things, and I don't want to lose everybody. And I think just the overarching idea of all this is that, you know, obviously we want to start at the basics. We want to make sure that we're investing with money that we don't need, that we have all of our debts paid off, and any of our short-term money things are taken care of. You know, if you're planning to buy a house, you've got some savings for that. If you've got some big expenses coming up, you're budgeting for it. Because having money that you don't need going into an investment, like for example, the stock market, is going to give you more peace of mind wherever things do go down or up or all that kind of stuff. You can sleep easy and invest for the long term, which is our recommendation. For the sake of this episode, please don't trust internet strangers. You want to go and you want to do your own research. We've given you some tools here. We're going to link some stuff into our description of our YouTube stuff. So there's a stock screener tool that Dan's created. And there's an example. We do a breakdown on one of our videos of smart centers. All the I forget what it's titled, 10 5 things to do stock research. Anyway, we'll link it in the description.
Yeah, basically it's a bunch of resources that we've created that's like kind of the high level, like first quick 5 minutes of research sort of stuff. The idea being that there's obviously a lot more research you want to put into these things, not just that. But we know that if we post the 1 hour video going over every little detail, the average person that we deal with is not going to invest that kind of time. So we made a quick 5 minute screenshot of various things that you could look into as your first stepping stone along the path of getting your research done. The idea being if it's short and relatively concise, hopefully that will, you know, get you started on the path and capture your attention for long enough to actually apply these simple lessons and then take your learning further down the road.
And your fallback is always, if you're, again, if this whole episode was just like repulsive to you, you don't want to do any of this stuff, then index ETF, you know, broad the market. Don't bet on one horse, bet on all of them. And then if you want to go even easier than that, then do one of these robovisors, but be mindful it does cost a little more money in terms of fees, but it is a in terms against a mutual fund, it's more self-directed than a mutual fund. You have more control. You can buy and sell when you want, depending on which account you put it in. There's caveats to that, of course, but in general, you can buy and sell when you want with this account, and it and invest in kind of the whole market for you. And that's all I really had to say.
All right. Well, that's it for now. So have a look at some of those tools that we're going to post, and don't forget to follow us on Spotify and give us a share. Our channel's been growing quite a bit. We just hit a recent milestone of 1,200 views.
1,212 listens
Ugh.
with 82 Spotify followers.
So that those 1,200 listens, that's great, but we got to pump those followers up. So give us a share. Make sure you follow us on Spotify or whatever podcasting platform that you listen. It really helps the channel out. And then the more we grow, the more we can spread this message out to people who really need to hear it.
Yeah.
So we appreciate the support.
Hey, you know what's been really cool? Someone posted on Blossom their top five favorite podcasts, and in the comments, one random person I never really talked to before was like, "A Money Basics podcast."
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, "Sweet."
Right on. Yeah, I've been getting some feedback from like people that I know that maybe not necessarily the closest with, or some even some decently close friends that I wouldn't have expected, like random people from sort of all branches of my life, randomly reaching out here and there, be like, "Hey, I've been listening to your stuff," and sometimes it's quite surprising, and sometimes not as surprising, but it's just super cool to hear that people are responding positively to this, whether it's teacher from west of us in Ontario that we've never met in our lives, or your close friends or distant friends or people on Blossom. It's just super cool to hear that we're reaching some people.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see like some of the avenues that have been blowing up more than others. So like our original like target was like Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, right? And those are like our three lowest performing in terms of subscribers. Now, partly our fault because we're really not pumping the YouTube content as much as we probably should be. But like Instagram is an example. I think we're up to like 60 or 70 followers on Instagram, which I anticipated more at this point. But Blossom being a new app, I find it interesting. Like I'm up to 200 followers. You've got 20. Again, I'm a lot more active on Blossom than you are, but between the two of us, we're up over 200 followers on Blossom. That's really cool to see. Appreciate that.
Yeah, it is super cool. And then also we've got the Medium articles too,
Right.
which that's blown up. We've got 900 and something followers on that, and that's that actually drives revenue. That's really the only, shouldn't say the only, but it's the biggest contributor to revenue, which is cool because that's what we use to fund all the fun stuff that allows us to create these podcasts and that sort of thing. So
Like the microphone, the laptop.
yeah, that's right. Just a quick announcement for the channel. I am leaving by next weekend to go on my 5-week trip abroad. So you may either see a slowdown in the frequency of some of these things or a slight shift where maybe Jordan's going to have to run solo or bring on some guests to fill in for me. But I think we'll probably do some posts on socials to kind of show off the trip a little bit and what that's like. And then I think we'll actually produce some content out of it eventually. Getting into sort of the budgeting vacation sort of stuff, which I think will be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that.
Good. Bring on some guests, eh? Give me free range to the business.
You got the keys to the kingdom, buddy.
All
All
right.
right.
Appreciate you guys listening. Yeah, we'll see you on the next one.